Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Race and Lanes with your hosts Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Race and Lanes podcast. I am your host, Rico Muhammad, coming to you live tonight from Atlanta, Georgia. We are going to be joined here shortly by our special guest, transportation attorney Hank Seaton. So what that means is tonight is the legal night. If you got questions about anything legal, whether it be contracts, negotiating, anything like that, give us a call. Press number one. Well, hopefully you're already listening in. But if not, I'll go ahead and say it because this is a recorded show. But if you're listening to a recorded show, the call-in number will be 563-999-3508. We want to try to definitely, if you got a question, press number one. That puts you in the call queue. We know that you want to get up and on board, and we'll get to you and try to mix you into the conversation as quickly as we possibly can. Want to start off the show. First off, I got a couple of little housekeeping notes that I need to take care of. I want to apologize to all of our listeners of the podcast for the technical difficulties of last week. We're not sure exactly what was going on with the phone lines, but things were just not cooperating. So we want to thank you guys for your patience and thank you for coming back and joining us again tonight. But those things were totally out of our realm of control. Hopefully we won't have those issues again tonight or going forward. And with that being said, let's jump over into this week's information coming from DAT from the Trendlines report. Freight rate remains high, remain highest in 13 months for vans and reefers. This report was published, it was published today. Van load volumes recovered to pre-holiday levels in the first full week of the new year. While load counts grew modestly for reefers and flatbeds, van and reefer rates dropped a few pennies compared to the previous week, but are still at the highest levels in the last 13 months. So let's take a little bit of a deeper dive, take a look and see how the rates were performing. Well, actually, the price of diesel. Diesel price went up by 0.3 percentage points, so we're showing the national average diesel price at $3.08 per gallon right now currently. And jumping over to see how the rates were performing over the previous week, we're going to start off with dry vans on the spot market. And as soon as my technology cooperates with us, we'll get that information up and on board. Here we go. All right, so starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, we're showing outbound average spot market rates at 179. Moving down into the southeast, we're showing average outbound spot market rates for dry vans at 190. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing that outbound spot market rate averaging at 227. Outbound spot market rate in the south central portion of the United States at 180. And outbound spot market rates coming out of the west coast averaging at 190 per mile. Moving over into the flatbed segment of the report, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate coming out of the northeast at $2.14. Coming out of the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing outbound flatbed rates at $2.25. Coming out of the Midwest, leading the nation, $2.45 average spot market rate. Down in the south central portion of the United States, an averaging flatbed rate is at $2.13. Wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, showing an average outbound spot market rate at 196. Jumping over into the temperature control reefer portion of this report, coming out of the Northeast, we show average outbound spot market rates at 203. Coming out of the Southeastern Mid-Atlantic portion of the United States, we show outbound rates at 211. Coming out of the Midwest, we show outbound rates at 277. That leads the nation. And coming out of the South Central, we're showing outbound rates at 232. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing outbound rates at 237. Taking a look at the fruit and vegetable truck rate report, we got a couple of areas that could be some hot areas for you guys. We have the chart is really got some movement on here, so we've got quite a few areas to list off that there may be some potentials to be had if you're pulling dry vans, vented dry vans, temperature control reefers, and possibly even some flatbeds. So this kind of report kind of covers the gamut. But the areas that are showing outright shortages of trucks currently, Central and South Florida. We all know how Florida works, so make sure you're doing your due diligence before you just go tracking down. Idaho, Merrill County, Oregon. Upper Valley, Twin Falls, Burley District, Idaho. Minnesota, North Dakota, Red River Valley. New York right now is showing an outright shortage of trucks in Columbia Basin, Washington. Areas that are reporting slight shortages, so that means you still some opportunities there. Central Wisconsin, Yakima Valley, Winchy District, Washington. Mexico crossing through Texas. Michigan, San Luis Valley, Colorado. All of those areas that we just listed off are either in the slight shortage category or the outright shortage category. So there is a lot of opportunity to be had on the spot market. And the reason we kind of cover these reports and we talk about these things on the show is to kind of give you a little bit of an indication that you may be able to have the ability to negotiate a little bit harder when it comes to negotiating your rate when dealing with brokers. So with that being said, I want to go ahead and bring on my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Chuck, how are you this evening?
We're doing well. How are you, Rico?
I'm doing great. I was a little disappointed. You know, I'm a huge college football fan, Chuck, and my team played in the national championship last night. And unfortunately, you know, we got to tip our hat to the LSU, Louisiana State University. They whooped my team last night. They whooped them pretty good, you know, and coming from me, that's a huge thing for me to admit to, but they put it on us pretty good last night. They put it on us pretty good. I had to go to the gym and work off a little aggression because
Well, I'm glad you worked it out because we can't have two aggressive guys, you and Hank, on the phone together. God knows.
Well, speaking of Hank, let's not waste any time. Let's go ahead and get him up and on board because, man, we got a lot of stuff that we need to cover tonight. And so let's go ahead and grab Mr. Seton. Hank, how are you this evening? Thank you for joining us on the Rates and Lanes podcast.
I'm doing well. My condolences to you. I was an ACC fan, but I got to say that LSU bunch was tough.
Yeah, they put it on us last night. I've been a lifelong Clemson Tiger fan all my life, and you know, we had a 29-game winning streak going on, but hey, such is life. To the winner go the spoils.
But you know, if you win too much, the rest of the world hates you. That's what happens from being a Blue Devil basketball fan. So you know, y'all win it three or four times, that just turns the country against you. So you'll be better off.
So Hank, it's been a little while since we talked. And there has been a lot of movement going on. The owner-operator model is still under constant attack. So catch us up. Bring us up to speed on some of the things since the last time we talked as far as things that are going on, things that we might need to be aware of. And why should the average guy listening in to this show, why should he even give a damn about what's going on in the news when it comes to the owner-operator model being under attack? Why? Because some people may not connect.
You've asked some good questions. Last time we talked, I had a pretty pessimistic view of the continuation of the owner-operator model because it seemed to be a foregone conclusion that AB 5 in California was going to go into effect, and there were a number of nanny states lined up behind it to come in with the same legislation. And that legislation would have had an ABC test for whether an independent contractor could survive in the owner-operator world. The B prong was the real issue. If the alleged independent contractor was in the same trade or business as the prime contractor, he'd be classified as an employee. And, of course, in California, we had a case called Dynamex that said that that was fair for the independent contractor. The effect of that would mean that every independent contractor would have to be paid on a W-2, wouldn't get to write anything off, would have to have workman's comp, and be treated like an employee for tax purposes. That would have taken away all of the entrepreneurial benefits extended by state law and resulted in an additional cost for an owner-operator or the carrier he's hired to of about 30% in ephemeral benefits. California and other states want to make as many people employees as they can because they got so many homeless people they got to feed. They need the tax money. And that's one of the reasons that there's such a great push in states that are bankrupt to end the owner-operator model. Another reason, quite frankly, is a lot of these state legislatures are beholden to labor unions, and they think that if people are employees, they're a whole lot easier to organize. And, you know, the Teamsters would like to be resurgent, particularly in the California area where you have got the dock workers union supporting it. So it really is a dichotomy of views. And by that, I mean the independent contractor model, which has been a success story for small carrier entrepreneurship for 40 years, was under virulent attack in California. Something has happened since Christmas that gives us some encouragement. There is a state court judge who has issued a finding saying that California can't do this and that Dynamex is crap because of what's called federal preemption. Now, the doctrine of federal preemption says that a state cannot pass legislation which interferes with interstate carriers' routes, rates, and services. So the argument is if California goes out there and says, well, maybe you're an independent contractor in 48 states, but you can't be in California, and that has an effect on routes, rates, and services, it should be trumped. The recent California state decision is a good sign. So is a good sign in a California Trucking Association petition for a temporary restraining order in federal court. That doesn't mean to say we're out of the woods. The case will still be appealed to the Ninth Circuit. Don't think for 1 minute that this political divide is going to end. One thing you ask in your question is what position should the owner-operator small carriers take in this? And this is my bias. My bias is that it is the American dream for people to be able to choose to be independent businessmen. And whether you got $100,000 invested in a storefront or whether you got $100,000 invested in a truck, if you've got skin in the game and want to try to be an entrepreneurial success, the nanny states shouldn't take it away from you. The wolf in sheep's clothing to me is these other entities that say, oh, well, you need to be treated as an employee because you ain't got enough sense to choose to be an owner-operator rather than be a company driver. So now the question becomes, what can and should listeners do if they agree with the fact that they're an independent contractor and an owner-operator because they want to be? And that is that they are the unrecognized force in all of this. So far, it's been the ATA and to some extent West States Trucking that have shouldered the burden of trying to defeat AB5 and represent the independent contractor model. But at some point, the voice that hasn't been heard is the small carriers and the small owner operators who don't view it as sweatshop on wheels, who view it as an entrepreneurial opportunity. In the California case, there is one owner-operator who's representing the class in the federal suit that the California Trucking Association is advancing. And I think that's about time. I think it's about time that the newspapers and the press, which seems to ignore the fact that in the California ports, the majority of the owner-operators and small carriers are immigrant minorities who came here to be independent contractors. And at some point, whether the plaintiffs in that case ask or whether we start grabbing the microphone and say, hey, wait a minute, this is not a nanny state issue. This is an issue in which we want to be treated as independent businessmen. That needs to occur. And, you know, I think, Rico, you and a number of your listeners that I have worked with over the years are the silent majority in a way in this whole thing. There are at least 800,000 independent contractors, and let's face it, owner-operators are the breeding ground for small carriers, and small carriers are the breeding ground for large carriers. So what it really threatens is a lot of the entrepreneurial zeal that is in the owner-operator model. So that's my diatribe on it. If you ask me what you can do to help, is Rico, you're showing that people that are on it might very well send you an email saying, I'm an owner-operator, I want to be one. If there's a petition, add my name. Because, you know, if you just read the press, traditionally it's been portrayed that it's some kind of serfdom that you're an owner-operator.
So we talked, you spoke about California. Now, are we still at a situation going on over in New Jersey as well? There was something going on in New Jersey that I recall that was on the radar for a little while as well.
I think there has been a bit of a pause in New Jersey. At the 11th hour, the ATA sent a letter, but probably more importantly, the New Jersey and the California legislation applies with a much broader brush than just to the independent contractors. You know, in the California legislation, they would say that Uber can't hire part-time drivers on a load-by-load basis without being their employer. In these kinds of legislation, they say that, you know, if you are a journalist and you write part-time for the newspaper, you can't be an independent businessman. The newspaper has to put you on the payroll and make withholdings. So I think particularly in New Jersey, a lot of other affected folks may have been kind of the East Coast intellectual people who like being an independent contractor came out of the woodwork too. So basically, I think Jersey is sitting on passing its legislation to see what happens with this this current court challenge. I monitored pretty closely. I've got attorneys in New Jersey who send me any update. And at this point, no news is good news for New Jersey.
Okay.
It goes a lot broader though than I know that even companies like UPS and FedEx and a whole bunch of them. Even to the point where they use bicycle riders in metropolitan areas that are really owner operators. They're not they're contract workers for FedEx and UPS and some of the other courier companies, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, so it's, yeah, listen, what you say is the bad facts makes bad law. Now, we all know that if you own your own tractor and lease it to an over-the-road carrier, you pretty well get to see the USA and turn down loads, and you're really not too controlled by the independent or by the carrier lease to. The model, when you start talking about the less than 10,000-pound GVW, the Sprinters and the vans that are showing up in everybody's neighborhood with prime Amazon painted on the side,
right,
is the worst-case scenario. And those people are really in the gun sights of the nanny state, largely because they're not subject to federal safety regulations, yet the Amazons of the world want to put all kinds of constraints on them. It is something I would never let a carrier put in their owner-operator contract, that the truck had to be painted with the carrier's colors, that he had to wear a shirt that said Amazon, that he was micromanaged and committed to providing 250 deliveries every day. And if he wanted to take his truck somewhere else, he had to turn it back in. The provisions in that space are what one client called the Wild West. There are no laws. And Amazon has been sued in three different jurisdictions for misclassification and class actions. And that whole area, I doubt there's anybody on the phone call tonight that's particularly interested, but it's an area that I've had to dig really deep in, because several little trade associations I work with involve these Sprinters and vans. I call them special delivery vehicles. The driver does not have to have a commercial license. The equipment doesn't have to be inspected. The driver doesn't have to be drug tested. The insurance requirements are de minimis, so there are really no rules that apply to that, other than, and it's arguable as to whether or not federal or state law even applies. So it's that segment of our industry, Chuck, that really is too hot to handle right now. The larger
okay.
carriers that are getting into it, like Hunt and old Forward Air's in it, and XPO to a certain extent, most of them are staying with straight trucks where federal regulation and interstate commerce rules apply. The acronym that is used for the Amazon freight is CRAP. You can tell
okay.
what that says if you
right.
if you say it out. It stands for can't realize a profit, and that's the underlying issue of the small van parcel delivery. There's not enough money. When you say that freight is free and returns are free, there ain't enough money to go around. And so, the question becomes how you, even if the van doesn't cost you any money, how are you going to make any money if there's no margin? So that's
right.
a whole different issue.
Okay, so
it's the dog's breakfast.
Shifting gears a little bit, I've got a question from a listener pertaining to wanting some advice as far as, I don't know if he's actually in this situation or not, he didn't clarify, but we've had a lot of carriers close down lately since the last time we talked, Hank.
Yep.
So you got people that may be leased on, maybe company drivers, to these different defunct carriers or whatever, and maybe having some issues with as far as collecting final paychecks and things of that nature. What advice could you give to the listeners about if they find themselves in this type of situation, and what are some things they need to do to kind of protect themselves?
Well, if they are independent contractors, there's flying the logos of the now defunct carrier. They're required by regulation to be paid in 15 days. They are a separate class if this carrier files bankruptcy. They don't have the same rights and remedies that you would if you provided the service to a shipper as Crescent Carriers. As Crescent Carriers, if the broker or forwarder goes out, the first thing I'd advise you to do is see who the shipper is on the bill of lading and start beating up on him to get paid, because in theory, you know, you provided the service, and unless Section 7 signed on the bill of lading, you have recourse. The owner-operator, he doesn't quite have the same remedies. Typically, owner-operators go into bankruptcy as a class and can get some kind of preferential treatment, although they don't have any legal status. I have seen owner-operators when that outfit out in Oklahoma closed down just say, well, I'm going to sit on the damn freight that's on the truck until somebody pays me, and that's one man's hijacks, another man's lien. You really don't have any right to do it, but I have seen those kinds of things done. The other thing is, in theory now, you've got a good argument if the company has a maintenance reserve or something that is trust funds, that you should be paid that. What you should lose at most is your last 2 weeks' pay. Now, if you've let that guy drag you and you haven't gotten your paycheck every month, every week, then that's a good sign you need to do something early, particularly in this day when you really don't know who's going to fail next. I haven't seen that much problem with the owner-operator because of the 15-day pay requirement. But, you know, I think if you're one of 400 owner-operators and you all missed the Friday paycheck, you got reason to do something quickly.
Okay, I got another question that just came in. Listener wants to know, what if you're leased to a carrier and in your contract it says no force dispatch, but now they are requiring you to stay out 10 days or more? Is that a breach of contract?
Yes, that is a breach of contract, certainly. And any carrier who does that throughout their system is certainly exercising a level of control that subjects them to a class action suit throwing out the independent contractor model and for reclassification. Of course, your issue is, and this has always been the issue, that the contract is bilateral, and in theory, if they aren't holding you there because of some tie with the tractor, you probably need to go find somebody else who allows you greater freedom. I think we all know that a lot of the large companies may pay better, may have a sign-on bonus, but their model is really based upon a promise to get you home every 2 weeks because they need some dependability of operation. What I have always suggested to carriers, to big carriers, is to go to the independent contractor and say, now, look, we want to be certainly reasonable with you in terms of your home time and your need, but in order for us to get you miles and get you home, we need some advance notice of what your willingness is to leave Atlanta and get back home for the weekend, or are you willing to let us keep deadhead and get you on the road for a full week? Just let us know how we can work with you, because we're business partners. And I think that approach is the most winsome. I mean, you know, for years, Landstar has referred to their owner operators as independent businessmen. And, you know, to work, you need to be able to work together, particularly with this new issue of control and misclassification. And the misclassification suits have been brought against all the major carriers, and they're still going to be here after AB5 goes. You've got to be able to demonstrate when they come after you, if you're a carrier, that no, we didn't put this guy with a dispatcher. We had a independent contractor coordinator, and we truly gave him a choice and made accommodations for it. Now, I've had clients who said, look, Hank, we've got a dedicated run. How do we get dedicated equipment from independent contractors for that? And I have said, I would offer to independent contractors this proposition. Look, we ordinarily pay you 80% of revenue or whatever it is. If you're willing to participate in this particular customer's demand, which is for a dedicated service, and sign on for a series of shipments on a weekly basis with notice, we'll pay you 83%, which gives the independent contractor the choice. I think to just say you're going to be in breach of contract or you're going to sit if you don't commit to two weeks. Away from home, certainly something I'd never advise a carrier to insist upon.
Good point.
So hopefully, listener, that answers your question. That's really man. That's unfortunate on a couple of different levels. Now, Hank, tell me this: legislative wise. Coming out of D.C., because I'm just trying to make sure I touch all the points while we got you here with us, because it's been a little while, like I said. Coming out of D.C., is there anything else that we might need to be aware of or something that's coming down the pike as well, or has everything kind of been quiet on that front?
Well, hopefully no news is good news. Some of the good news that the agency doesn't want to highlight is the Department of Transportation's Inspector General, who was required to look at SMS methodology and vouch for the fact that it was now fit to go, looked at it and said it's not fit to go. So there's this glaring omission to complying with the FAST Act to say that the agency can do anything with SMS methodology. The IRT, which was their pivot, isn't being developed. So I don't think during this calendar year you're going to see any kind of rulemaking or changes there. Unfortunately, the agency is still creating SMS scores, and those scores are still getting circulated to insurance companies that are still being used in court by plaintiffs bar to result in increased insurance prices, and everybody who's buying every small and large carrier is going to get another big insurance hike, particularly small carriers. And the reason is the insurance companies aren't making any money, and the reason they aren't making any money is because plaintiff's bar is using this infernal SMS score to say that every stump toe needs to have a message sent to the carrier because he had a hours of service violation 2 years ago. So it's a big circle, and it's a big circle that we're seeing played out in terms of higher insurance rates and more difficulty for small carriers. An interesting sideline is, after being kind of asleep at the wheel for a long time, ATA has published something in Transport Topics about nuclear verdicts, is looking into what causes nuclear verdicts after the the Werner verdict, and I think it's all going to get tied back into the effect on insurance costs, and maybe the larger carriers are starting to realize that they need the little guys to survive. I was talking to an insurer today, and they said that only true tort reform to keep this demonizing of carriers out of the jury is ultimately going to do any good. So that issue is still there, but in terms of a legislative call to action on that, there isn't one. Some of the problems, I think particularly for small carriers and owner operators, has been this ELD conversion, although you can't blame the agency because it said it was coming and it was going to be draconian, has hit. I'm just sitting here looking at Trimble, which is PeopleNet, asking for an extension from the agency to repair its equipment. Apparently,
yeah, we're with PeopleNet. They have been a phenomenal supplier up until we've had some issues all of a sudden. And, you know, you're so dependent on technology that it really, really, it really hurts when it fails because you're married to it.
Not only does it hurt when it fails, but the bureaucrats are unyielding to it. Let me give you an example, Chuck. You know, my phone's ringing off the hook with people who had loyalty to PeopleNet and were convinced that their older units could have a simple fix rather than go out and get some untrusted technology. So when all of a sudden they had this kind of computer glitch that we had back in the year 2000, there were people who were really sweating about it. And it didn't take the FMCSA but 2 days to start plugging in what's called an E-Rod. And an E-Rod is a program that will go deep into the bowels of all of this data, and in 30 minutes say, Chuck, here's your fine, because
right.
It will discover things like missing miles, like alterations. They program this to get anything, whether intentional or not, would be a false log. And if they deem this by the numbers to be a false log, then you go to safety prison for it.
Oh, yeah.
I've got one friend who is in the business of helping people through audits. And he told me this last week that 4 out of 5 carriers who've been audited had been fined and given a conditional safety rating based upon this plug-in. Well, the sad part about it is the carriers don't know about the plug-in, or they'd be monitoring their own self and correcting the logs. So we have filed a FOIA, which is a Freedom of Information Act request, with the FMCSA saying, look, if you're using this device to spot violations, then we want to see the program so we can use it to prohibit the violations. And we say, hey, look, you guys got to be transparent and accountable. You can't come in with some secret sauce that we haven't tasted. So far, the agency hadn't turned that over to industry to use. I think that is kind of typical, which is you really can't have a prosecutor or a policeman who's coming in enforcing rules you don't understand and aren't published. And that's really what happens for small carriers when they're told to go out and buy this data and here's how to make it work, but don't have a full understanding of what's expected and what's a violation. And that is really a current topic. I'll give you one more example. Rick Gobble and I went down to a little country town to help a small carrier out. His driver coming northbound had I was about to run out of hours, and he pre-planned his trip enough to know there was a rest area. He got there, and there was a big sign that said no overnight parking. He logged into personal conveyance and went through a scale 2 miles later and was cited for a false log. All he was doing is exactly what the agency told him to do. It took the small southern town 6 months to get into court. In the meantime, his insurance ran out, and he got billed an additional $22,000 to keep his insurance. All of that is has no common sense. The idea that that something like that could take a guy from zero to 77 on hours of service, cause him to have to pay $21,000 to keep his insurance, and then be dismissed 6 months later is a lack of due process, to say the least. And unfortunately, that example is not the only one. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of the promise of bureaucratic rollback, of getting the government off of your back, of coming up with rules that say, look, we come in and see the extent to which you're in compliance with existing rules. We don't try to draw parallels between crazy scores and future crash predictability. So,
you know,
I think
maybe
I'm
just a dumb Canadian.
We're going to have problems in the future. Go ahead, Chuck.
Hank, maybe I'm just a dumb Canadian, but I was under the understanding that United States was now, you know, was had, under this current administration was more business friendly. This doesn't sound business friendly at all. This seems, like some sort of a dictatorship, a third world dictatorship. I think if another country was acting like this, you may want to send in the Marines.
Well, you know, I wasn't very popular when at a trade show I said the problem was the dark estate. What you have at any bureaucracy is well-meaning people that become zealots and become encroached, and they're there regardless of who the elected official is. I don't think that the Trump administration has really taken to heart the need for regulatory reform. But there is one thing that we're going to try to use effectively. That is, the Department of Transportation has come down with a rule that says that if they are going to change in any substantial way an enforcement item, they have to put it through rulemaking and can't do it by guidance. Now, unfortunately, that agency for the past 6 to 8 years has been using what they call notice and comment rather than rulemaking. So, for example, with respect to preventability, which is a totally corrupt idea, they'll say,
right,
we're taking comments and we want everybody to comment on this. How can we improve preventability? What positive response have you had to using preventability? So, I mean, they skate the landscape. They control the narrative. So if they don't really give you an opportunity to force them to make decisions that they have to make in terms of, is this effective? What's its adverse effect on small carriers? What's the cost-benefit analysis? And when they don't have to look at this as a rule, it just becomes something that they can really throw out there on their website, and industry doesn't get a chance to make a record or have any basis for appeal. And there are things in this new DOT ruling that gives support to what Congress has said. Now, you know, are we going to get a change of administration in here and go back to the status quo ante in which, you know, we've got a new broom and we're back to Obama stages in which, you know, the government knows best? I don't know. But I think you are right that I've been disappointed in the failure of the current administration to look at serious regulatory reform agenda that we presented to the agency, to the DOT itself, and to this MCSAP committee. I can rage against the agency, but I can tell you there are some people there who just have a different view of carriers than I do. They basically feel like if they can mathematically use a logarithm to identify RICO as a bad actor, then they can send in somebody to audit him until they prove it. So, I mean, you know, they really kind of want to the idea of a fair and easy audit sometimes gets lost in the methodology for selecting who to audit, and that's inherently unfair.
You know, that's something we should probably discuss on a future show, because it'd take a little bit too much time tonight. But how to, because I have been audited a couple times, probably about three or four times through in the last 40 years. And we should probably have a discussion for our listeners on how to prepare for an audit and what to do when the auditor arrives, and, you know, how to behave, basically. That's something we should discuss, because that is going to happen to some of our listeners.
Yeah, if you hear you're getting a full-fledged audit coming, give me a call, and, you know, we'll get somebody who to sit there with you. And be sure that you know, they get what they're required to get, and that you there's no slip between the cup and the lip in terms of how the audit's conducted. But look at this fact: the federal government told the agency that every motor carrier should get a safety rating. There are 535,000 motor carriers. That's 535,000 safety ratings. The vast majority, 90% of the carriers, have no safety rating. You pass a new carrier audit, you don't get a SAP.
Right.
Every year, at even using all the Ouija board SMS methodology, they're only able to issue 12 or 15,000 new safety ratings a year. That is less than 2% of the industry gets an actual safety rating. Well, now, you leave everybody else out there with a broken-down system that gives them no safety rating. So plaintiff's bar, when they have an accident, says, well, they didn't get a satisfactory safety rating from the agency. Mr. Shipper, Mr. Broker, you should have examined them, and the court, you get to decide whether or not they were safe. That bastardizes the whole program, and it's particularly prejudicial to a small carrier, because if the small carrier's $1 million won't go far enough, the shipper or broker is going to be sued, and all of a sudden shippers and brokers say, well, we feel a whole lot more comfortable giving all of our freight to C.H. Robinson because they're big enough to indemnify us than to deal directly with the small carriers. So you can see it's a circle. It's a vicious circle that ultimately is prejudice. Ultimately, every carrier who's out there operating should have either a conditional or a satisfactory safety rating. If they've been through a new carrier audit, if they haven't been through one, they ought to get one every 2 years, because it only takes a couple of hours and of computer time. And at that point, we wouldn't have a lot of these problems we've got. We've told
I
that
agree.
To
I actually
get,
I sat through,
you know,
a new carrier audit myself. I think it was about three, 4 months ago for our Chicago operation that we opened, Traffic's Trucks. And what they do in Illinois is they bring a bunch of inspectors down from up from Springfield into Chicago, and you go to a DOT building, and you go in as a new carrier with all your information, with your driver files, your maintenance files, and they go through them, and you go through it. And I asked him, I said, well, do you do this for every carrier in Illinois? And he laughed. He said, no, this is your new carrier audit. But what I'm thinking is, why doesn't the agency or the government, for gosh sakes, if there's a cost to doing a real audit, and let's say it's $1,000 or $1,500, charge it to the carrier, and maybe the government can make a little bit of money at it.
Well,
the carriers
look at
can
it
get
this
a real
way,
audit.
Chuck, we took their figures and their support for the new carrier audit, and we figured out that to give the new carrier audit over the telephone with the electronic submission of the things that they got from you in Chicago, by their own admission, would cost $400. And we said, look, when a guy re-ups his data, which has got to be done at least every 2 years, conduct a new carrier audit. The new carrier audit that you went through wasn't these guys came in and said, you're a bad actor, we're going to stay here until we prove it. It was an objective audit.
Right.
Let me see your random drivers. Let me see your driver qualification file. And, lots of times, particularly on a new carrier audit, if a guy is close to compliance or something, they say, well, correct this and we'll do it. I mean, but it would give them the kind of protocol that it takes for them to do their job and say, look, we went and looked at this guy with at least the same tooth of comb as the local health department goes through restaurants every year or two.
Right.
And looks to see if there are rats in the kitchen. I mean, that at least gives shippers, brokers, and the public some indication that the dude running down the road has been reasonably inspected and certified as safe to operate and safe to use. So that's our story, and we're sticking to it. It's just in the rhetoric that is Washington and the problems that Congress has got, we've just got to praise the day that the Thud Act came out and didn't have what the Democrats wanted in it, because they wanted a reaffirmation of SMS methodology. Some yo-yo put in there that every carrier ought to have $5 billion in insurance. So at least it did us no harm. We're getting a little close to time. If I got one more argument I'd like to talk about, if you'll indulge me. You made mention of the fact that we could talk about contracts. I have in the past month come to realize that a large number of brokers are now putting their contracts on the web, and it's being managed by a third party, and they're typically telling small carriers, take it or leave it. No changes. If you're desperate for that load, you sign this contract. Well, I am seeing the worst of the worst in terms of these contracts. And I am giving real consideration to starting to grade these doggone things and find a way to make the grades and the scores available. I understand that small carriers can't pay a lawyer $300 to go look at every contract to haul a load. But at some point, little guys need to know that some of these things are just hazardous to your health. What is happening is large brokers are being told by shippers, look, it's in our contract. You're going to have to deliver this by 2 a.m. or you're going to have to pay special and consequential damages. You're going to have to pay the weight. So brokers know they're having to accept that liability. And if they want to do business with certain outrageous shippers, so they just put those terms in their contract and everybody signs it, and they don't know when it's going to get pulled on them. But trust me, it will get pulled on you at some time, and you'll have a huge cargo claim for which you have no insurance, and you simply find that the broker has offset it against your receivables. It's heartache personified. If anybody on this line has a small carrier, and he wakes up some morning and finds out that a $30,000 offset has been taken against a cargo claim that isn't covered by insurance because there was no mitigation or real damage. And I'm just saying that I'm seeing this as a real twist that has gotten us away from insurable risk for cargo, particularly when you start saying that if you don't deliver the shipment by 10 a.m., Mr. Retail Grocery can reject the load or tell you to sit for 2 weeks. Somehow, it all gets jammed down small carriers, and I don't know whether better information's the answer or what is, but I know that it's an unsustainable risk. I see the works on it.
Let me do this before we get out of here. I got a listener that's got a question real quick. Let's try and weave him in here real quickly, and we'll wrap up. So, caller from the 704 area code, you're up live. What's your name, where you're calling from, and how can we help?
Hey, Rico, this is Jim that talked to you earlier. You made me remember Hank, and I actually got some advice from him about a week ago. So, hi again, Hank.
Sure.
Yeah, say, I've got my real quick question is I was mentioning, I was the one that asked about the higher liability, you know, and got your answer, which was great. But I'm obsessed with that Werner, that nuclear Werner verdict for like $89 million, and I was reading that. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind commenting how do they get away with there's no legal basis to put a higher standard on the truck than the pickup truck to hit the tree. I mean, for anybody listening, the Werner truck did everything right. They slowed down for winter conditions, and they were driving one, you know, say eastbound, and the pickup truck was driving the other way, and the pickup truck's the one that lost control, crossed the median, hit the Werner driver, and yet Werner gets blamed for and sued for, you know, $89 million or something like that. So I was just like, it just seems absurd that there would be that the plaintiff could get away with there's no legal basis that I could think of to say the truck has a higher standard, and also the fact that, like, I drive through Wyoming a lot where it's when it's icy all the time, you know, and you're trained for that, you know. So if I was the one in that same snowstorm in Texas, odds are I'm driving safe because I'm probably going to go 45 or 50 and keep a nice following distance. So I just don't get how this happens, you know, and can we stop that, you know, to keep our insurance reasonable?
You know, at one point I mentioned the need for tort reform. That means state laws should be reformed so that the most that a plaintiff can get is for actual damages. What happens is plaintiff's bar, and, you know, they advertise. I don't know if there's anybody on this phone that doesn't at late night see people advertising Morgan & Morgan, we're for the people, or Bart Durham, and plays a picture of some
You're
dude.
You're turning my stomach, Hank.
of some dude who's shinning under a limbo bar and having a party, and it says, Bart Durham got me $500,000. Well, we live in a world that is so suit happy that plaintiff's bar comes in and just plays on the emotions. And especially if it's a bad accident, they say, look at this poor dude. He's not going to have consortium with his wife. He can't work. He's going to forever be in that wheelchair. Somebody must pay. Well, the driver has got $30,000 worth of insurance in the four-wheeler, and making him bankrupt isn't going to get the plaintiff's bar very far on his 40% commission. So he's got to go after a deep pocket. And Werner is the ultimate deep pocket. So that's why the large carriers say all this is unfair, because, you know, it's their lucky day if you're going to get hit that you got hit by Werner or J.B. Hunt, not that you got hit by Crescent Carriers. So, you know, their demand is basically based on show me the money. How much insurance have you got? What are you worth? give me half of it. And that was the reason, you know, we had the discussion about whether or not if you got out and got the extra $1 million worth of insurance, would you just be inviting plaintiff's bar to demand $2 million when otherwise they take $1 million and figure out that, you know, causing you to forcing you into bankruptcy would mean they take last after PACCAR. So that's why the big carriers say it's unfair that you don't have $5 million because they're going to get tapped for a whole bunch. A lot of large carriers. In fact, I had a phone call today with an insurance company, and they said, yes, we were involved in this lawsuit. The carrier only had $1 million worth of insurance because he had enough sense to put all of his equipment in an equipment leasing company. So, yeah, they'll end up paying $1 million, but they're not going to go after the carrier because he's not leaving a lot of hard assets in the company. And, you know, I think that's the way most small carriers are viewed, and that's why, you know, the insurance companies say, well, gee, you know, the small carrier is going to put a demand on us to pay $1 million, and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, for a premium on one truck, we're looking at $1 million worth of loss. So, I mean, the dynamics is different. But at the end of the day, you got to look at what's your company worth, and are you going to be a target for plaintiff's bar? What happens is your shipper or broker will be the deep pocket target.
I understand. Well, I just don't get the legality of court. I was curious how that works. I mean, doesn't there have to be some legal basis to find Werner guilty for something they didn't? I don't understand how the whole jury trial works. I guess it seems absurd.
Well,
what they said,
and I think this is bad law, but it gets right back into this preventabilities thing. They didn't say that the Werner truck was the proximate cause of the accident, which is the legal standard. They said that the Werner driver wouldn't have been waylaid on the road so that he could have been hit by the four-wheeler if he'd been properly trained. And under the crazy notion of preventability, they said this accident was preventable. Well, you know, that is the craziest legal standard anybody's ever heard of. And
I agree.
That was actually in Texas, of all places, which you would think would be a very pro carrier state.
Yeah.
When you look at it, though, a plaintiff's bar has got some little cubby holes where they do the best they can to bring it in a particular jurisdiction to get it in state court because they're just known to have runaway juries. And a lot of that absent tort reform, which caps the recovery, means that, you know, they know that maybe Hinds County, Mississippi is going to give bigger judgments than Tupelo, and so they file it in Hinds County. And, you know, I have and it's called forum shopping, and it goes on all the time.
Oh, gee. So what is your estimation of Werner's appeal on that? Any idea what's going to happen? Do you have any – I mean, Werner should win that, but what – because didn't Walmart just win an appeal like that?
Well, I don't know. Walmart may have – Walmart, I think – I thought Walmart settled that Tracy Morgan thing.
Yeah,
and I know Walmart
too.
Walmart hit a really bad snag in a classification suit in California. So I don't know of any Walmart successes. You know, I'm sure with that much money out there, they have to appeal it. I haven't heard, and a court could cut back the judgment. But, you know, it's really interesting to me that the current acting administrator of the FMCSA is the former general counsel of Werner. Now, one would think that Jim Mullins, if anybody, would realize that there are adverse consequences from the term preventability, which the way the agency is enforcing it means that unless it was a deer strike or you were front-ended by some drunk, it's going to be deemed preventable. So, you know, that whole alternative standard is just a plaintiff's bar dream. You know, if they can convince a state law judge that, well, look, Your Honor, you know, this would have been preventable if Werner had trained this new driver how to drive on snow. Well, you come back and say, hey, man, the guy was off the road on the side. How can you find him culpable? Well, the answer is if you sued the poor dude in the pickup truck, there wouldn't have been any money to get. You know, you've got state laws. You've got state laws in which if it's intrastate commerce, the guy may only have to have $100,000, but the federal amount's $1 million. So, you know, one could say, hey, look, tell me again why, because the guy's a commercial motor driver, he should have to have 10 or 20 times the amount of a 16-year-old. Well, you know, everybody 16-year-old wants to drive, and it's just the fact that there's $1 million should be a windfall to the poor victim. You know, you look at the people that get injured in a motorcycle accident. You know, motorcycles kill more people than trucks do. And who's going to insure those poor dudes for $1 million?
Poof. It's a sad reality. But thank you for your answer.
Yeah, it is. It's you know, it just shows you how bad our judicial systems are. And you know, Canada's not as bad as the U.S., but we're following suit. We've taken some of your bad habits, and we're starting here. It's nowhere near as bad, but give us a little time. We'll follow right behind you.
Well, you know, I cannot make a defense for my profession on this. I've got to tell you that, you know, it's tough. It's tough to be a lawyer and see the way that not only plaintiff's bar, but also defense bar handles these big cases. They'll take 3 years of discovery and then settle for policy limits on the courthouse steps. And, you know, the trauma that puts a carrier through with all of the depositions and the waking up at night saying, what the hell's going to happen? Do I continue to make an investment in the company, or is the plaintiff's bar going to take it all? You know, that's a miserable life. You know, those kinds of things ought to go to binding arbitration and ought to be resolved in some other fashion. The medical profession's basically got it down. I mean, let's face it, there are a lot of more people killed in hospitals than ever gets tried. But pretty much if there is a claim of negligence against the doctor, there's a mediation program it goes through, and the doctors have got enough insurance. Most of those things settle without being kind of the Werner case that attorneys got rich.
Yeah, you never hear of a $90 million settlement because somebody died on the table because of a doctor's mistake. You never hear of that.
Oh, I bet you do in this country.
Well, there's certainly some big settlements here, but I guess maybe the hospital lobby is better than the trucks. It seems as though it's so easy to demonize the truckers, and there's still an aura of a little halo around most doctors' head.
Yeah.
Say, I'm going to guess that Louisiana must be a high-paying state, because driving through there, no matter what interstate you're on, whether it's 10 or 20, you see this Morris Bart on these billboards. I mean, there must be 100 Morris Bart billboards saying he'd been hurt in a truck accident. He just put those up in the last year or two. They are everywhere. But anyway.
Well, you know, the funny part about it is some of the defense bar are happy to feed the cases to certain advertising plaintiffs, because they know those dudes will never try the case. They just they're working on high volume, and they're more than happy to take their 30% of $1 million, which is $300,000, without belaboring it. their other plaintiff's bar who fly in their private jet and bring seven people with them to take depositions because they think they really got a tiger by the tail. And my guess is that whoever it was that put Werner through the ropes was one of the latter type lawyers.
Whew.
Well, I'm sure.
That's just still out, so outrageous. I so hope somehow Werner wins that appeal.
They might
be
still going to cost them millions of dollars to appeal this, and a lot of bad press.
I don't see it that way. It's bad press. I mean, it's if you're not in the wrong, that's just, at what point? I think at one point, if the trucking industry doesn't defend itself, it'd just be double that next time. It'd be $180 million next time.
I agree, but you know, when you're a shipper and you're looking through your index or who you're going to use for a load, are you going to use the guy you know has a 89 or $90 million lawsuit going on, or somebody doesn't have one? You know, that's how shippers sometimes think. So this is not good for Werner. They're a great company. You know, we use them sometimes, and they're a wonderful company. They do a great job. They're good corporate citizens. They do everything right. You don't hear a lot of bad stories about, you know, about the Werner Group, for as big as they are. And, you know, they're a well-run company, and they don't deserve this, but you know what? It sucks to be in this business sometimes because that's the issue. And,
Chuck, you're absolutely right about Werner, but Werner's soft spot is that they have always been a supporter of training new drivers. And, you know, just like I had teenagers and the first wreck was on me. I think that in this particular case, what plaintiff's bar tried to drive home is that they had a neophyte driver who hadn't driven on ice and snow. So, I mean, there's not a carrier out there that plaintiff's bar with enough discovery can't find one blip. And, you know, it's the issue where it redounds though to a small carrier is in contracts, shippers are saying, well, look, the broker or the carrier has got to indemnify me against any up supply chain liability. Any cause of action arising out of the transportation service provided. So that means that a poor man's indemnity isn't worth much. So, you know, a large carrier like Werner or a large broker is going to say, look, we'll accept that indemnity obligation, and we got enough bucks to hold you harmless. So, you know, then comes in, that's why a lot of them want to go through a 3PL and pay them that goose up, because if they wanted to manage their own traffic department and hire small carriers, they say, well, yeah, the guy indemnified me, but, you know, that $1 million is all he's got. You know, where's the money going to come from if plaintiff's bar gets a $5 million judgment against me? And that's what's called the poor man's indemnity, and that's what, you know, comes back to result in small carriers having more difficulty getting direct access to shipper-only freight.
Yeah, and it's going to get a lot worse. You know, if these lawsuits continue, and some of these nuclear decisions in various courthouses throughout the United States, if it continues, the insurance companies are going to just keep raising the rates, and trucking costs are going to be just like they were when I got into this game 46 years ago.
Yeah, I'm doing a presentation in 2 weeks on insurance. And I've been casting around to bring somebody else on from an underwriter. And, you know, what I have found out is all of the insurance companies say that they have lost money year after year for the past 5 years on premiums. So from their point of view, they're just saying we got to raise the rates. We're not in it to lose money.
No, you can't blame them. Who wants to lose money?
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that we're looking at for this trade organization is Can we put together a captive? Can carriers raise up enough SIR to be kind of self-insured at some level and have control over the fender benders? I don't know. If you just have to go to the traditional market and it's a bear market, the discrepancy between what a well-managed large carrier will pay and what a small carrier pay could very easily be $10,000 a unit.
100%. Yeah, especially some of these rates that we're hearing.
I was just looking. We get ready to put a whole another hour in, and we ain't even recording.
well, let's just say we're gonna have a recess.
I think so.
Talk about it.
So we definitely come back and pick up where we left off. Hank, I want to thank you for joining us, for the listeners that stayed on for the overtime, I guess you want to call it. Thank you. God bless you for staying on with us that long. And we'll talk with you guys next Tuesday. Every Tuesday as you all know, if you're listening, we switch the show up to every Tuesday at 7 p.m. So we got some different things that we're going to be trying to do, bring forth. Go over to Facebook. Give us a like over on Facebook. Go over to Instagram. Follow us on Instagram. And if you have any questions, concerns, or suggestions, drop us a line on either one of those. Or if you want to, you want to shoot an email, shoot us an email at rakesandlanes@gmail.com. So with that being said, I guess we want to say God bless you. Good night. But Hank, do you want to tell? Of course, you can find Hank if you got questions or need his services. TransportationLaw.net, www.transportationlaw.net. That's his website. That's all of his contact information is over there. And, Chuck, you want to let people know how they can get in contact with you before we jump out?
Yeah, you can get hold. Sure, you can get hold of me via email, chuck@traffix.com, or you can call me, extension 203. That's really important, 203. Phone number is 800-388-4352. If you need to get set up with Traffix as a carrier, I'll hold your hand, take you to the right party, and get you all set up and get you hooked up with quick pay and everything so you get paid right away.
All right. With that being said, God bless you. Good night, everybody. We'll talk to you and hopefully see you same time, same place next week. Until then, be safe out there. Keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise, and we are out.
Good night, everybody. Catch you on the flip-flop.
Good night.